And hey, what is it about Barbara and fairies, you know?
This is the Gospel of Musical Theater, a priestly look at some of your favorite musicals, with your hosts, cathedral deans and musical theater queens, Nathan LaRude and Peter Elliott.
This is Gospel of Musical Theater today, continuing the Streisand series, Yentl.
Peter, can you hear me?
Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you see me? Papa, can you find me in the night? Papa, are you near me? Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you help me not be frightened? Looking at the skies, I seem to see a million eyes. Which ones are yours? Where are you now? That yesterday has waved goodbye and closed its doors. The night is so much darker, the wind is so much colder, the world I see is so much bigger now that I'm alone.
Hey, Nathan, can you hear me?
We're jumping ahead. We're jumping into her directorial debut. What she said when she won the Golden Globes was, "This is the most fulfilling artistic experience I have ever had."
And oh my God, what a journey she had getting there. Over 10 years, just attempt and failure to get this thing going because the producers didn't want to do it, studios didn't want to do it.
Yeah, nobody wanted to do it. Yeah. Even though she was, you know, she was one of the top box office stars. You know, if anybody should have been able to, I mean, I guess, you know, she was finally able to make it happen because she's Barbra Streisand. But it's interesting to me how many people turned it, even when it was like, I'm going to sing, I'm playing a Jewish girl. Like, this is kind of solidly in the Barbra Streisand genre. And for some reason it was, I suppose too ethnic, too, who knows why people didn't want to make this film. But she had to fight.
And 1983, the notion of a woman playing a man, not for laughs,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, it was still a little ahead of the cultural curve.
Maybe. She says, you know, it's basically just Shakespeare, right? This is basically just Twelfth Night. And she's right. This is a, you know, so yes, there is a way in which I can imagine 1983 people are like, I don't know. And I mean, you know, she also got a lot, you're too old for the role and no one will believe you as a man. I think that was what her partner, John Peters, who also like really... Sounds like, you know, basically that was kind of why she finally decided she wanted to do it, was to prove him wrong. You can't make this film. You shouldn't make this film. You're too old and no one will believe you as a man. So she dressed up like a guy one day and, like, walked in on him. And he did not fire a gun on her, but almost did. I think she was a little terrified. But then I think that was kind of when he was like, oh, okay, I guess you can pass this off. Although, I mean, Peter, do you buy her as a boy?
Well, because she's always Barbra Streisand.
She's always Barbra Streisand.
And you know that. I mean, the willing society. Suspension of disbelief here was almost impossible for me, you know? It just didn't get there.
Yeah. It is. I mean, she describes it as a fable. It's not quite a fairy tale, but it is a fable. And some of that is you have to buy into the conventions, right? This is a little bit of a folk tale. There's a little bit of not quite magic, but something sort of similar to, you know, it's based in reality, but also based a little bit in something that's larger than reality. The music, I think, helps us sort of telescope out of that. So there are some conventions, and some of this, you know, they are the conventions of Shakespeare, right? Like this is a dramatic trope that we know. What happens when a woman pretends to be a man? How does that and then what does the love dynamic look like there? So yeah, at one level, I think we can. Observe the conventions and understand what's happening here. It does have a little bit of the, you know, it is very clearly one woman's obsession, one woman's 10-year obsession. She read the story 1968. She just made Funny Girl. She says it's the first four words of the story that grabbed her after her father died. Right? Like, those are the first four words of the story.
And can we just pick up the bridge from On a Clear Day You Can See Forever and her autobiography where she and her brother, if I've got the story right in my memory, went to a medium to contact her father and actually had an experience of being contacted from the others.
Mm-hmm. Papa could hear her. Papa not only heard her, Papa said, what, proud? I think he spelled out proud and singing, or proud, like, basically, I'm proud. I mean, she understands that he was telling her, you must make this film, right? She made Yentl because her dad told her to, from beyond the grave. So she said it was the most terrifying experience of her life. I get the sense that she absolutely believes what happens to her was real, and she never wants to experience that again. But it did allow her to, I think, reconcile with the dad who died before she could remember him in a way. I mean, so in some ways, like, Yentl is Barbara's processing this relationship with her father. It really is about a father and a daughter. If there's a romance at the heart of Yentl, it's probably Yentl and her dad. Mandy Patinkin and playing Avigdor comes in a, we'll talk about Mandy Patinkin. But yeah, this is
a
really
young,
about,
very hot Mandy Patinkin.
Oh my God, he's so gorgeous in this film. I just, like, in that river scene when he comes out of the water and his, we don't have to go too far down into my little Mandy Patinkin nude bathing fantasy. But oh my God, that scene, every time I watch it, and then he's like lounging against the log with his knee, like, kind of propped up, very decorate, so you can't see, but oh my God. Everything about it, just like, I become a, 13-year-old boy again, like, breathing very shallowly. Yes, it's a very exciting
and
moment.
And apparently was just no fun whatsoever on the set.
Yeah.
She names names in the
she
autobiography.
She really does. I'd love to hear his, I was going to Google to see, like, has he responded to the allegations? Because he's still alive. Have they ever had a chance to, like, kind of lay this thing to rest? The way that she tells the story, he assumed that they would have an affair. And was very mad when clearly that, I mean, and she says, like, I had no interest in Mandy Patinkin. And there's a piece of me that thinks, like, you know, as I watched it with that story in mind, I thought they really don't have a lot of chemistry.
No,
I mean,
chemistry at
all. You can see her kind of, you know, and she says, like, you know, I basically restaged the ending because I couldn't film a sex scene with Mandy Patinkin. Like, I just couldn't make that believable. I wasn't into him enough to make it. So, like, they don't really ever, the film is very cagey about whether Yentl and Avigdor actually get their moment in bed, which in the original script,
she had more sexual energy with Amy Irving, really.
She really does. And actually, in some ways, like,
that's the hot scene.
That's the hot scene. And she, you know, she talks in the autobiography about, like, when Amy Irving started, like, grabbing her hand, you know, like, basically kind of touching her off screen, you know, like, and she was like, well, I don't really know what to do with it, but if it helped her enter the fantasy, okay. I mean, basically, kind of very practically. But you do get the sense that Barbara's a little bit terrified. That's too strong a term. She doesn't seem at all interested in the question of like, what's going on for the character Yentl when she agrees to marry Hadass. Like, is there anything there other than this is her way to get at the man that she loves, Avigdor? Barbara doesn't really want to. I don't think for Barbara Streisand this is a queer story. I think she understands this as a story about a woman being emancipated. And there's a piece of me that says, okay. And there's a piece of me that's like, oh my gosh, this is the queerest story you've ever made. You don't seem interested in, like, Avigdor falling in love with a boy. You don't seem particularly interested in Yentl marrying a woman. And, like, how, I mean, the Singer story, you know, like, they're doing, there's no spilling of wine on the wedding night, right? Like, somehow Yentl, as Anshul, figures out a way to satisfy Hadass on their wedding night. And the Singer story gives us no detail. I don't think Singer is particularly interested in how two women can possibly do that. But it's a very queer story. And Barbara doesn't really seem interested in going there.
Her project is very different. It's second-wave feminism. She writes in her autobiography, the story, talk about Yentl, is about a woman who defied expectations, a woman who wanted more than a conventional life of darning socks and cleaning house, a woman who wanted to fill her mind with ideas, not just what to make for dinner. And that felt very relevant to me into the times. That's Barbara's project. I mean, that's describing what it was that she was seeking to do in her show business career, not get put into a box of being a Broadway performer or a wife who darns socks mm-hmm. and makes...
Or just an actor who sings, a singer,
yes.
An actor. She wants to direct, write the screenplay. Like, she wants to do all of the things that men typically do.
Yeah.
And has to fight, right? Like, pretty considerably to get creative control, to get her budget. And finally, then she and, you know, like enters the echelon of Hollywood directors, and there's not a lot of other, I mean, like who, I, she talks about walking into a party and there's like one other woman in the room who's directed a film who won't even like make eye contact with her. I think she felt like a pariah, but did, it was sort of like, I mean, I think it was sort of the moment of literally joining the boys club, right? Like walking into this room full of men, some of whom she admired, some of whom she, I don't think had, you know, like had a lot of love for, but finally, I mean, like this is her moment. She has always wanted to direct, and finally she gets to do, and this is like Yentl finally getting to study yeshiva, right? Like she, Yentl wants to study texts, Barbara wants to direct. I think they, this is very much an autobiographical film for her.
I agree.
In just about every respect.
And it's been fairly well respected. I mean, it won the Golden Globes, she for Best Director, it for Best Film. She was snubbed by the Academy.
Yeah. This would not be the last time that she would be snubbed by the Academy.
Yeah. And that was, she got some other awards after that. She describes all of the process of the both acclaim and disdain of this film. Seems like people either love it or they just dismiss it as not too interesting. I'm somewhere in between, as usual. I don't love this film, but there's some beautiful moments in it. I think it's Roger Ebert who says the beginning and the end are terrible. The middle is great.
The middle is good. Yeah, it is. It's I read that too and thought, oh, that's interesting, because he's not wrong. The middle of the film is the most interesting part. It begins a little clunkily. I mean, and maybe, I mean, the film is best when Barbara is playing a boy, which is so interesting, right? Like, I mean, she's good as Yentl at the beginning. Although, you know, all of the scenes in the marketplace and he's, you know, like the guy coming in with the cart, right? Like sacred books for men, picture book. I mean, it is a little heavy-handed in terms of illustrating the world that Yentl is rejecting. So yeah, that some of that's fair. Although there's also a piece of me, you know, Barbara did not want to make this into a musical, right? She agreed to sing. She worked with her favorite lyricists and her favorite composers, Michel Legrand, the composer, and then Alan and Marilyn Bergman, who had written songs for her in the past, basically kind of as a way to get the film made. I think that's, she basically realized after talking to a bunch of different producers, nobody will let me make this film unless I agree to sing in it. I'm going to have to sing. Okay, I can do that. We can write some songs for Yentl that will allow me to illustrate what's going on for Yentl, which we really don't get at all in the Singer story. I mean, like, there's not a lot of Yentl's interiority. Actually, Singer does not seem that interested in what's going on inside Yentl. But Barbara is, obviously, so writes music for Yentl. But the film is not really a musical because nobody else sings. And I understand, you know, it's like she said, I don't want to do one of these big opening marketplace, you know, Fiddler on the Roof had already done that. I don't need to do tradition at the beginning of Yentl to illustrate the world of the Eastern European Jewish ghetto. That has been done. Fair enough. But there's a piece of me that's like, I kind of want the beginning of Beauty and the Beast, you know? Bonjour, bonjour. There goes the baker with, I mean, like, she's basically Belle, right? She's walking through town with her nose in a book. And there's a piece of me that's like, I kind of am, I'm interested in that Yentl that's actually about a community and where you do observe the conventions of musical theater and you get a crackerjack opening number that introduces you to the world of the town. And then Barbara gets to sing Papa, Can You Hear Me, which is her I Want song. And at some point, like, Avigdor gets to, you know, it's like, you've got frickin' Mandy Patinkin as your love interest. He's got one of the most beautiful voices in musical theater. He doesn't sing a note in this film.
I know.
I don't know. I'm a little disappointed by that, I have to say. Like, I want to make a case for including this film in the Gospel of Musical Theater because it is a film in which Barbara Streisand sings. But I would love to see a true musical. And it does feel a little bit, I mean, she's in every single frame of this
Every
thing.
Frame. And instead of the Beauty and the Beast opening, you get Where Is It Written? Which
is a great song.
It's a great song.
Actually,
I think it's the best.
It's a great song.
It's the song that I find most compelling out of the whole score. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I find the whole score kind of dull and boring. It's a vehicle for Streisand.
Every song sounds like every other
song.
That's
what I think,
too. They all kind of run together.
It all runs together.
And some of that's Michel Legrand. He has a particular idiom, and it's basic. It is kind of a medley. The whole thing is kind of already basically a Yentl medley. But I agree. Where Is It Written? I think both. I mean, it begins as a prayer to God, right? Like she's in. Her father has gone to bed. She dares to take. You see her caress the bag that the prayer shawl is in. She takes it out. She puts it over her head, and she begins to pray.
I'm wrapped in a robe of light, clothed in your glory that spreads its wings over my soul. I mean, it's beautiful prayer.
God, a merciful Father, I'm wrapped in a robe of light, spreads its wings over my soul. May I be worthy.
When I watch her do it, I cry a little bit every... It's like she is... This is... I mean, so the way that Barbara understands, right? Yentl is a woman who wants to study Torah, right? So...
Yeah.
And when... Yeah. Okay, that's awesome. I also want to say, like, I think it's a little bit deeper than that. Yentl is a woman who wants to pray in the way that she sees the men praying. I think Yentl wants that kind of a relationship with God. Or maybe Yentl understands herself to have that relationship with God, right?
Yeah.
Yentl prays. She knows herself. And so, you know, like, but there's this way that only men can pray in her tradition, which is to put the prayer shawl on. And then when she finally does it, I think the way that she opens it, right? That's meant to be sort of the Bergman's version of Jewish liturgy, right? Like, I am putting this thing on. I am clothed in your light. Studying Torah, I think for Yentl, it's not just about, like, you know, I wanna understand the world. That's kind of where is it written, right? Like, why does a bird fly? Why is the world made the way it is? I have all these questions, which is really her way of saying, I don't understand myself, right? I don't understand why God has given me this curiosity. I wake every morning with all these questions on my mind. Like, how could God have made me this way? So at one level, it's like, yeah, she's intellectually curious. She wants to understand the world. She wants to read books. This is Bell, right? Like, she has the life of the mind. I think it's deeper than that, right? Like, Yentl wants to pray in the way that her body longs to pray, in the way that her tradition, the way that she can see men, the way that her father prays, the way, I'm guessing her father taught her to pray. Her father taught her to pray as a man. And Yentl wants that. I mean, this is Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, right? Like,
yes.
Tevye's deepest desire is to have enough time to sit in the synagogue and pray, and maybe have a seat by the Eastern Wall and discuss the holy books with the learned men 7 hours every day. This would be the greatest thing of all. That's Tevye's deepest wish. That's what Yentl wants. And I mean, at one level, like that, I love that because that's. I mean, that's. That's what I want. I think for many of us called to religious life in all sorts of different ways, you don't have to be ordained to experience this, are longing to devote ourselves to sacredness in this way, to prayer, to study. I find that so beautiful. And I think Barbara really illustrates that so beautifully. Actually, Where Is It Written really captures that piece of it. It's deeper than just intellectual stimulation. She wants to be with God.
And because this project took so long, she actually did a fair bit of study. She studied with rabbis. She studied, if I've got it right, with a conservative, a reform, and an Orthodox rabbi, and got the different interpretations. And, you know, she quotes the great thing. I always have said, two rabbis, three opinions, but two Jews, three opinions. This whole, and I think it's one of the things that Christianity sometimes is deficient at, is this principled argument about text. We get into excommunicating each other, right? And not the Jews haven't done that, of course, as well. But at the heart of Judaism, as I understand it, is this notion that you find the meaning of text as you not just discuss it like at a polite Anglican Bible study, but really get to grips with how the text is meaning and how it's speaking to us and how we interpret it, and having its interpretation be very lively and passionate debate. That's kind of what she longs for. And I think what Barbara the person learned as she is preparing for the role.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. There's something about this engaging in this disputation that she finds really liberating. So at one level, it's right. Like, it's like she says in the autobiography, like, I never really got to go to college prepping for Yentl, studying with these rabbis. That was kind of my, she finally gets to go to yeshiva. I mean, this is actually the story of Yentl, right? Like, she gets to do the thing. You do get this. I mean, some of that is like, I think that's her way of prepping for the character. Barbara's a method actor, though. Like, it's like she has to create Yentl inside of her. She has to experience what it's like to yearn to study, to then get the thing that she has longed for, to get to pull apart these questions. And what she finds so liberating is, like, it's not about learning answers, right? It's about learning, you know, that the Talmud is preserving a conversation, a debate, right? Like, and we don't resolve it. You get to, like, enter into, you know, Rabbi so-and-so says this, Rabbi so-and-so says this, right? Like, this disputation that's happening. This is how yeshiva study, you know, like, you're partnered with Yentl and Avigdor get partnered together. That's, you know, like, they're study partners. This is how Jewish study happens. You are engaged in dialogue and debate with other people in the class, with these texts. You're studying text. You're studying an argument. But it is then up to you to decide, like, what do you think of this stuff? And that's not the way, I don't think, that Christians are taught to engage our texts, right? We are taught to mine them for answers. It's a very different orientation to the world of sacred texts. Barbara finds it liberating. I also find it liberating.
I love it. One of my rabbi friends says, quoting an ancient rabbi who I can't remember, that the Torah is black fire on white. The fire are the words, the actual letters on the page. The white is the color of the page. And the text means it's alive. And its meaning is dynamic, not static, right? The Holy Scripture speaks to us always in the moment and isn't this kind of, oh, I'll upset some of my friends, the Calvinist notion that it always means the same that it ever has, that the interpretation is where I'd say the Holy Spirit is found. The Spirit of God is found not saying, well, Holy Scripture has said this, therefore that. The Spirit is found when the text becomes alive and challenges our deepest assumptions and makes us look at the world in a different way. That's what excites me. And it excited Barbara. I mean, she...
Yeah, clearly she gets really into this.
She discovered, yeah. And it's something that most seminarians learn in Old Testament 101, that the word Adam, the name Adam, does not mean a dude's name. It's earth creature, and that the earth creature is both male and female. Not that a male was created first and then a female. And she says in the autobiography, but if Eve was actually made out of Adam's side, that's a whole new concept. Adam, where is it? Here it is. Adam was not gendered. Rather, was two genders, both male and female. The androgyny of the soul, she talks about, doesn't explore that really in the film at all. But I love the notion of androgyny of soul.
I do too, and she clearly does too, because she replicates that argument. I mean, Avigdor and Anshul, Yentl as Anshul, have that argument in the film, right? Like where Yentl discovers that what she has been taught was Adam's rib, that Eve was kind of this tiny little like helpmeet, is Adam's side, and it blows her mind, right? It blew Barbara's mind, blows Yentl's mind, because Yentl is as a character is struggling with this question of like, I mean, she's like, I can't be a woman and do the thing that I want to do. Now, see, and this is where I think the Singer story and Barbara Streisand's version of the character are kind of departing, because in the Singer story, what Yentl's father says to her very early on is, you have the soul of a man in the body of a woman. And then Yentl asks, you know, like, well, how can that be? And the answer, which Barbara elides from the film, but the answer in the story is, even heaven makes mistakes. Now, Barbara, I think, now, what is Singer doing there? The Singer story is tricky in some ways. I think, you know, Isaac Singer does understand Yentl almost as a cautionary tale, like almost an illustration for why the Torah prohibitions against wearing the clothing of the opposite gender should be observed. Yentl puts on men's clothing, and it basically turns her into a kind of a demon in the context of the short story, right? So it is...
It's transphobic in some way.
It's transphobic in some very tricky way. Also, I mean, Yentl, in the story, Yentl starts putting on her father's clothes before it ever occurs to her that she can, that this is a means to study. You get the sense that Yentl is someone who understands herself as experiencing a kind of gender dysphoria, right?
Like, yes.
The body that I am in is not the body that reflects who I really am. So there is a way which, even in a very transphobic story, you do get the sense that Yentl is a character, a transgender character, right? A character who understands her biological gender to be different than the gender that she actually brings to the world. Now, in the story, she, you know, like, there, it's basically kind of a tragedy. She's kind of doomed to, I mean, Singer even talks about it. She becomes a new version of the wandering Jew, right? Yeah. Wandering from town to town, this kind of demonic figure, a woman dressed in the clothing of a man, a woman with the soul of a man. It's a problematic story that way. Barbara's not interested really in telling that story. She's interested in telling a story about a woman who doesn't really care about what she's wearing. Her clothes are, you know, like, that's not the important thing for Yentl. The important thing is, like, she wants to study, and the only way she can do that is by passing as a boy. So it becomes a means to an end. She's not interested in a character who experiences her gender and her sexuality in a queer way.
And that 1983, that wasn't really a conversation. I mean, when I think of the ongoing coming out of so many of us, for us old queers, my generation, I remember having conversations with friends saying, you know, we're okay about things. We're not sure about this trans thing, like 10 years ago. We're going to wrap our minds around that. So 1983, the trans agenda wasn't really there. She didn't want to go there.
She didn't want to go there. She doesn't even really want to, you know, and it's a little surprising to me as a woman with a gay son. And by the time she's making this film, Jason has come out. So, you know, she's going to go on to engage the normal heart. I don't know if we're that's a conversation for another time. I just listened to her whole thing on the normal heart the other night, and I have so many questions and thoughts about it. But Barbara Streisand by 1982 is a woman who is in dialogue with the gay rights movement.
Yeah.
She knows that she's got a gay kid. She knows that a lot of her fans are gay. She never, like, so at least I'm waiting for the time in the autobiography where she really talks about that. Like, does she understand herself to be a queer icon? I assume she must. I haven't gotten to that part in the autobiography yet. But all of this is a long way to say she doesn't really seem all that interested in Avigdor's experience of being, I want to say, attracted to his male study partner.
For sure he is. I mean, that's there.
And that's all over the Singer story, right? Yeah. Like, the text even compares them to David and Jonathan. It talks about, you know, like, their souls being knit together. Avigdor, you know, like, I mean, and the plot points are all set, right? Like, obviously, that's the reason Avigdor says to Anshul, you should marry Hadass. Avigdor's in love with Hadass, knows he can't have Hadass. And so it's both like, this is the way that Hadass can be in my life. But also, I mean, like, basically kind of, you know, invites Anshul to be a part of this kind of polyamorous triad, this kind of interesting queer romance where all, my sense is, what's really happening here is all three characters have both an intellectual and an erotic connection to each other.
Yes.
Right? There's something about Yentl, Anshul, but Anshul as Yentl, that, like, Hadass falls in love with Anshul. Hadass is attracted to Anshul. In the autobiography, we get the sense that Amy Irving was at least trying to build a relationship with Barbara Streisand where she would be able to access sexual attraction, right? Grabbing her hand off camera, being very affectionate with her. Barbara seems weirded out by that, right? Like, she is uninterested in exploring the potential eroticism of the relationship between Hadass and Anshul. Fair enough. That's, you know. But there's a piece of me that's a little disappointed that she is not interested in how complicated and fascinating. Because to me, that feels like the relational response to what she's so intrigued by intellectually in studying Torah and studying Talmud, which is like, this is much more complicated.
Yeah.
Gender and sexuality are much more complicated than we were taught to believe. So she's interested intellectually in that idea, but isn't really willing to engage it in terms of bodies.
Yeah. And because I think she is so clear, her through line is women should be able to do what has been stereotypically given to males to do. Any obstacles in their way are need to be overcome.
Yep. This is the patriarchy. The patriarchy is going to stop us at every point. So, we, structurally, we must work to dismantle these systems. Sure.
And patriarchy is not all about horses, as Ken discovers in the Barbie movie. It's my favorite line when Ken in the Barbie movie says, "Once I discovered the patriarchy wasn't all about horses, I lost interest." But that's another conversation that I'd love to have with you, because I actually think Barbie is a musical. But there we go.
There's a gauntlet. That'll be our next season.
Meanwhile, away from the horses and the patriarchy, back to Ligental. she is, I think, Barbara's so intent on driving that agenda and the queer story. I wonder whether she's a little afraid of in 1983. You know what I mean?
She never says this, but that's the sense I get too. Yeah. It feels like a little bit of transphobia, and it feels a little bit like homophobia. I want to be like, I don't want to, you know, it's like, who am I to indict Barbara Streisand? Like, I don't know her, but it does feel to me like there's an ick factor here for her that she just doesn't want to go there. And yeah, I'm a little disappointed.
She doesn't want to make Victor Victoria, which I think is around the same period here. Mm-hmm.
Yep, it's same year, 1982.
She wants, and I think the meta narrative of Barbara and this film project, both in the long gestation period, the journey that she had to get to it, and then its reception critically, its snubbing by the Oscars, it's an absolute through line about women can do it. She was the first woman director to win a Golden Globe, if I've got the story right.
And the last for a really long time. Yeah. I mean, up until like the last, decade.
Yeah. Yeah. And good on her. Like,
good on her.
And good on her actually taking this crusade through a religious lens, because Christians of the period, 1983, the whole move to get Equal Rights Amendment through and all that sort of stuff, there were churches, Christian churches, that were preaching about the spiritual necessity of defined gender roles long before queer issues became the issue that the Christian churches were facing. I mean, in an interesting way, this film, in its dealing with how do you interpret text, what is the role of women, and what are gender differences, kind of anticipates the major religious debates the last 40, almost 50 years within North American culture, driving on feminism particularly, but the rest of it's all there. How do you interpret text? Who gets to interpret text?
Where is it written? Who gets to decide?
Yeah.
No, in that sense, it does. It is reflecting its moment in some really interesting ways, right? This is the moment. Barbara studies with a woman rabbi. I think that's really significant, right? Like she's like, oh, that's a thing, right? Like that exists. It's like, yeah, she's like the one woman rabbi serving a West Coast congregation in the early 80s. So, you know, it's not widespread. But there are, for the first time, women who are now figures of religious authority who she can doubt. And that's where Yentl, that final scene, right, when Yentl goes to America. I think Barbara is hoping to illustrate there is a place. There's a place for this girl. She can go to America. I think, Barbara's not quite saying, but like there she can at least study, maybe become a rabbi. I mean, clearly that's Yentl's vocation, right? Like this is a woman who's called to the rabbinate. It's like, I know Isaac Bashevis Singer is like, well, what's going to happen
Lithuania?
To her in America?
You know,
she should just stay in Lithuania and go from yeshiva to yeshiva. It's like, no, that's not what Barbara wants for her. And there's a piece that's like, I kind of side with Barbara on this. At the same time, it's like when Singer's like, so she goes to America and goes to work in a garment factory. I'm like, yeah, that's actually probably what happens, right? Like in 1904, Yentl can't study Torah in America. I mean, if she waits a couple years, I think that's going to start. I mean, I'm not an expert in Jewish American history, but my sense is in 1904, there's not a lot of opportunities for her on the Lower East Side in Chicago.
And hey, what is it? what is it about Barbara and fairies, you know? Funny girl. You've got the fairy.
I thought you meant like you and me.
Yeah.
Fairies like you and me. Yes,
but,
there's that.
You know, it's a boat shot in Funny Girl. It's Hello, Dolly. And then, you know, the concluding, you know, the big pullback, the crane shot, the helicopter shot, I think it was, at the end of Yentl. She's on another fucking boat, you know? I mean.
I know. Papa, watch me fly.
It's a great shot.
The more I live, the more I learn. The more I learn, the more I realize. The less I know, each step I take. Papa, I've a voice now. Each page I turn, Papa, I've a choice now. Each mile I travel only means the more I have to go.
But haven't we seen this before?
I mean, you know, crossing water, right? Like she talks about, you know, how that when she made the film, she wasn't even aware of that. But like clearly, I think the reason she tells that story is that her argument here is I was working on something subconsciously and something about women on water, which is a kind of image of crossing over, emancipation, liminality, you know, beginning a journey. So some of that is like, you know, it works. It works dramatically. It works at the kind of the, you know, the metaphorical level, the metaphysical level. She loves a crane shot. So, you
of
know,
course. And who doesn't love a crane shot? Yeah.
But I mean, I love that image. Right. Like, and there's a piece, and this is why I'm very sympathetic to the story that I think Barbara is trying to tell, which is really a story about Jewish American identity.
Yeah.
Right. Like America is the place where we can finally be the people that we long to be. I think that's kind of her. That's kind of her experience as a woman, as a Jewish American woman. You know, like she's of a different generation than Isaac Singer. She's telling a different story. She's telling the story about the children and grandchildren of immigrants. She's the age of Yentl's granddaughter. She's Yentl's granddaughter.
Yeah.
She is finally able to do the thing that Yentl, her imaginary grandmother, could not. She can make a movie. She can study Torah in the way that her father studied Torah. Her father was a religious scholar. She's connecting with her father in that way.
Yeah, and I love the romanticism of the American immigrant story.
I do too.
But in the state of current politics, that is looking more like a myth, more like a fable, maybe a dream of a bygone era, because immigration now is a problem. And the issues around immigration around the world are heartbreaking and terrible and complex. So when I see that part of Yentl, the ending, I'm going to go to America. I can find freedom. There's part of me that my heart soars, the vision of the new world. And there's part of me in 2024 that says, I'm sad that that story is no longer as powerful or as possible for new waves of immigrants as it once was.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Oof, there's a lot there, isn't there?
There's a lot there. And oh my God, it breaks my heart. And it breaks hearts of so many around the world that she doesn't get the Statue of Liberty in the crane shot. Does she at the end? No, it's not there.
No, she should. The shot would work even better if she were sailing into New York Harbor. Yeah. And there she was, Lady Liberty. Such an iconic, that's such an iconic image of immigration. It is the romantic image of American immigration, right? Coming into Ellis Island, it's Emma Lazarus's words around the base of that statue.
Give me
Emma
your
Lazarus,
tired, your poor,
give me your tired, your poor,
huddled
your huddled masses
yearning
to breathe free. The wretched refuge of your teeming shore,
these days, right?
But that's the thing, right? I mean, the poem does contain that weird kind of ambivalence. Yeah. It's both denigrating where we come from, the wretched refuge of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. I mean, yeah, as an American kid who grew up, like, I know that poem by heart, right? Yeah. Like, that does do something to me, right? Like that poem lands in my body in a certain kind of way, right? That is the promise of
the great hope of America, right?
It's the great hope. And to a certain degree, it's like if I have any shred of patriotism left, I think that's where I find it, is that, like, that's an America that I can believe in. That's an America that is a vision of, I mean, it's what Barbara's doing at the end of Yentl, right? This is a place where our dreams can come true. This is a place where we can, it's the queer dream, right? Like, there's a place for us somewhere, a place for us. Peace and quiet and open air wait for us somewhere. So there's so theologically then I can say, yeah, I know enough about the American dream / the American nightmare.
Yes.
To know that putting your hopes in a political institution is ultimately, right? That's not. That's not a good, right? That right. You're setting yourself up for heartbreak. You're setting yourself up for, even worse, for violence.
Yes.
Put your trust in no ruler. The Bible is real clear about this. Some put their trust in horses, and we do not. God has no pleasure in the might of a man, in the might of a horse. Don't put your trust in institutions. Institutions will fail you. And that, the Bernstein song gets this, right? Like, it's the kingdom that lies beyond. Maybe we can attempt to build it in this life.
Yeah.
But if we attach that vision too inextricably to a political institution, we are setting ourselves up to be deceived.
Yeah.
That is a kingdom that maybe cannot exist in this world. I don't know, right? Because so what is it? Heaven? Is it, is that pie in the sky when you die and we should all just give up and wait until God takes us? I don't like that answer either.
And the excesses of Christian nationalism, both in the U.S. and in Canada, this idolatry of the nation state is, and getting the moniker Christian in front of it embarrasses me, makes me deeply suspicious of so much theology that goes on. But the ending, the song,
Piece of Sky,
which kind of like sounds like the Pippin song in some ways.
Corner of the Sky.
The more I live, the more I learn, the more I learn, the more I realize, the less I know. I mean, if that's kind of the message here about the importance of learning and the importance of education and the tragedy if a particular gender is withheld, women withheld from studying Torah in the story that Yentl tells, or the beauty of education and the importance of learning and of realizing, certainly my experience, as I get older, the more I learn, the less I know, the wonder that can come from the sheer joy of learning, which is, I think, Barbara, what's going on, I think, for her, every film that she has made, she's watched the director, she's fought with the director, and now she has the opportunity to do this herself. And she makes a damn good film, you know?
She does. No, she deserved that Golden Globe for Best Director. It's a well-directed film.
Yeah.
I love the way that she talks about her directing style on set, which is that she spoke very, she's like, you don't have to yell when people finally listen to you, right? Like, I mean, Barbara's sense of power is it is meant to be shared. It's something that she's doing in collaboration with her crew. She has a singular vision. She loves it when she can describe an idea that she's not even sure is possible, and the crew around her says, We can make that happen.
Yeah.
We can make that happen, you know, or at least we're going to try, right? Like, we're going to try to realize your vision. She's so gratified by that. I think because, like, finally people are paying attention to her. People are listening to her. She doesn't have to shout. She doesn't have to raise her voice. She doesn't have to demand.
Right.
She can be what she's always wanted to be, a collaborator with a singular vision and people who will work to make her vision a possibility. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a beautiful image of leadership, I think.
I agree.
It's certainly much more functional than, you know, the kind of autocratic, you know, demanding men who, you know, kind of straitjacket and force everybody to do what they demand. That's not my sense of how she works. Her crew respects her.
They respect her.
And they listen to her.
Because she respects them. And she has assembled a crew of people that she loves, that she respects. And then the group becomes smarter, more able than a single vision. Yeah. No, I agree about that, with that entirely.
Yeah. No, but I think you're right. Like, I mean, this is her, you know, Yentl is her, it's her more, right? It's like, I had a little piece of the sky, but this is my, you know, Papa, watch me fly, right? I mean, like that, I think that's Barbara singing to her actual father. I finally, right? Like, I'm finally doing the thing that you wanted me to do to make this film for you. Papa, watch me fly. I have more now. This is what I want. I want to direct. I want to produce. I want to be able to bring my vision to fruition. It is, in at that level, I mean, at the kind of meta level, it really works. I think for the character Yentl, though, I mean, it is, as you say, it's I had this little image of what I can be, you know, and it's about study, but it's more than study, right?
Yeah.
She says, no matter where I go, there'll
be not just knowledge.
It's wisdom, yeah. Right? The more I learn, the more I realize I have more questions than answers. I just have all of these questions. So, you know, if the character arc of Yentl is at the beginning of the thing, I have so many questions. Where is it written? God's made me as someone who asks too many questions, right? There's a voice in her head that's like, women shouldn't ask questions, Yentl, right? Like, you've got too many questions. That's a problem. There's a song that got cut from the film where she, it's like, how many transgressions am I committing every day? It's like, it's kind of Yentl's guilt song. It's her Jewish guilt song.
As God is watching, I'm committing several sins a day, and I commit them even as I'm sitting down to pray. I must admit that I committed several on the way. Oh, how am I to pay for several sins a day? I know he disapproves of how I'm dressing when I wake. He's adding to his list with all the apples I don't bake. And certainly he's noticing the babies I don't make. Oh, how am I to pay for several cents a day?
When she's aware that, like, I am disobeying every commandment possible in order to, and she said, like, my only defense is I'm doing this in service. I mean, she doesn't quite say it this way, but like, I'm doing it in service of God. I am disobeying these commandments so that I can go closer to God, so that I can pray the way that I think I'm supposed to pray, so that I can study the way I'm supposed to study. So it's actually, there's this really interesting theological meditation on transgressing commandments in order to be faithful to the commandments.
Yeah.
It's kind of fascinating. But then by the end, right, it's like she's broken every commandment possible. She's ready to kind of step into this new life. But it's not just the study bit, right? She still carries the Avigdor thing, right? Tell me, where is there someone who will turn and look at me and want to share my every sweet imagined possibility? That's the kind of the refrain there that kind of runs throughout the thing, right? The more I live, the more I learn. The more I learn, the more I realize, the less I know. I realize how much more I have to go. But she wants more. And it's not just she wants to go to America so that she can...
And what's wrong with wanting more? What's wrong with wanting more? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's where if there's a way to kind of bring the queer storyline back in here, right? It's like Yentl has had two experiences with people that have shaken her to her core. She falls in love with Avigdor and doesn't quite know what to make of that. And then she marries Hadass and gets to actually be a man in a traditional marriage. You know, it's like, that's her, it's the song about, you know, like, well, no wonder he loves her, right? Because she basically fetches and carries for him. Her every thought is how to please him.
No wonder he loves her. No wonder at all. The moment she sees him, her thought is to please him, Before he even knows that he's hungry, she's already there with his plate. Before his glass is even empty, she's filling it up. God forbid he should wait. Before he has the chance to tell her he's chilly, she'll go put a log on the fire, fulfilling his every desire. No trouble, no bother, no wonder she's pretty. What else should she be? She hasn't a worry, and why should she worry? When she gets up, her biggest decision is figuring out what to wear. To pick a blouse, a skirt, and then there's the problem of what should she do with her hair. And later, as she stands and studies a chicken, the question's to roast or to not roast. Or better yet, maybe a pot roast. Tomatoes now, potatoes. No wonder he likes it. It's perfect this way. Who wouldn't want someone who fusses and flatters, who makes you feel that you're all that matters, whose only aim in life is to serve you and make you think she doesn't deserve you? No wonder he loves her. What else could he do if I were? I would too.
And in the voice of Yentl, like, that song is sort of, you know, it's sort of sung ironically, you know, like, this is kind of, it's the second wave, it's a second wave feminist anthem, right? No wonder he loves her. She exists to please him. And the character is kind of dismissing that, right?
Yeah,
like, she wakes up in the morning without a thought in her head. Her only thought is, like, what to wear today? What should I do with my hair? Should I roast the chicken? Should I make him a pot roast? Tomatoes? Potatoes? You know, it's like, it's very dismissive of the domestic arts, everything related to kind of to women's traditional sphere, right? Why would you want that? That's a trap. That's just darning socks. And there's a piece that's like, yeah, sure, okay, yes. And also like, whoa, that's pretty cruel to Hadass. I think there's a lot more going on for this woman than just like how to please a man. But I get how, you know, the context of the film, the context of Yentl's character, right? Like, that's not the kind of woman I feel called to be, or it's even capable. I'm not even capable of being that kind of woman. But yet she's still, right? Like, she and Hadass are married for, I mean, how long, you know, we don't really get a sense. A year?
At least, yeah.
At least, you know, like, she is in an intimate relationship with this woman. So at the end, right? Like, yes, Yentl has finally emancipated herself from, you know, basically has turned down Avigdor. All you really want is somebody who you can study Torah with behind closed doors, right? Like, for all outward appearances, I'm going to have to be Hadass for you. Maybe we'll get a little bit of study in there, but you don't want me to study, really. You want a wife. I don't want to be your wife. So she goes to America, but she still longs for someone who will share this with her.
Yeah.
And that feels really important. I mean, you know, here again, I'm harping on my, right? Like, I want the queerness in this story. I want to find the queerness in this story. I don't want it just to be about a woman who is choosing the life of the mind over the life of the body. I want Yentl to experience what she wants, which is to be touched and to be held and to be loved and to find intellectually stimulating companionship, a true partner like Avigdor.
Yeah.
It's not just a mental game. It can't just be we connect intellectually. I want something more for her. And I love that the song gives a little bit, this little kind of, you know, this little echo of the fact that Yentl still wants this too.
Yeah.
She wants a relationship. Whatever, right? Like, and she doesn't quite know, I think, with whom or what that looks like. How is that possible? Who knows? It's in God's hands. She trusts that the desire is holy, even if the ways in which it can be lived out are not yet clear.
Yeah, and I guess to map on her autobiography, this is sort of Yentl, kind of the end of her relationship with John Peters. It's before the real love of her life, James Brolin. And I wonder to what extent she herself is struggling with, how do I, as a capable, intellectually savvy and curious, technically adept woman who's achieved, you know, stardom and can sing, but I want more than that. And how do you bring all of that into a relationship, an intimate relationship? I think that's still going on very much in her autobiographically when she makes the film. And she's so clear about, and it's an extraordinary achievement when you think about it. Star and direct and produce this thing.
Write the screenplay.
Yeah, the whole thing. God bless her. What an achievement. What an amazing
achievement.
It is.
It's a great film. You said that, you know, you don't love Yentl.
It's not a film. It's not one of your favorite films. But I admire it.
I do too. I do. I don't know if I would say I love Yentl. I can imagine living with this. You know, I remember seeing it when I was in college. I think it was in a gender studies class. It was one of the films that we were looking at. And performing gender, right? We were looking at a lot of critical theory, gender as a performance. So it's a, you know, kind of one of the classic texts in that. So, you know, kind of looking at it from that perspective. And I remember watching it a couple years ago and realizing in a way that I never had before just how gorgeous Mandy Patinkin is in this film. I mean, he is stunning. He just ticks every one of my boxes.
Yeah.
And then watching it again last night and, you know, and like remember, you know, it's like, oh, I have a lot of questions about this film. There's a lot of places where I find it frustrating. I do kind of love it, though. It's a film that I do kind of love.
It's worth taking a look at. For you gentle listeners, if you haven't looked at it, take a look at it.
I think for any of us who have struggled with in religious communities with questions of power and access, with the question of how to follow God, when that invitation seems to, when being faithful to the God that you think you are accessing through the deepest kind of prayer might mean seeming to disobey God's commandments.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like that to me, I almost don't want to talk about this. That feels to me like a very tender, but my sense is, at least in the communities that I have served, a lot of us carry baggage around that. What we were taught, and then how we learn to hear God's voice cutting through the shit that we were taught to carry.
And she sings that in A Piece of Sky. The lyric is, sometimes where danger lies, there the sweetest of pleasures are found.
Yeah.
And is that what you're gesturing to?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, like, even as you quote that line, there's a voice of me. I hear my conservative brothers and sisters in my head being like that. You know, actually, I saw a tweet of one of my fellow Anglican clergy talk, and this is talking about polyamory, which is one of the questions that we're dealing with and, well, not really dealing with in the Anglican Church right now. But he's like, you know, horny is not an orientation. Just because you desire something, you know, here I'm jumping to Christianity, which is a tradition that I know. Christianity doesn't have a lot of positive things to say about desire.
Right.
That is, you know, that is not generally code for holiness. It's usually code for the passions, for the devil.
For sin.
You know, it's like, yeah. I mean, like, I remember being, when I came out to my parents, I don't remember the exact parameters of the conversation, but my mom saying something like, you know, your desires are not how God speaks to you. If I followed every desire I had, they would take me so far afield. You know, like you don't follow your desire. Be very suspicious of your desires.
You don't trust your body. You don't trust what it is your body wants.
Mm-mm. You don't trust your body. You don't trust your, and like, you know, it's like I no longer believe that anymore. That script still has power over me, right? Like if I want something, that's probably a sign that it's me and not God. That it is ego. And actually, there's a piece of me that kind of does want to maintain a little bit of a buffer against horny is not an orientation, right? Just because I want something doesn't mean that desire is sacred. But I also don't then want to say, by virtue of wanting something, you must immediately dismiss it, right? Like here's where I want to pull something from the Jewish tradition, which is a little more comfort with argument, disputation, unresolved questions, arguing stuff out. This is discernment in the Christian context, right? Like, how do I distinguish the holiness of God's voice in my body, in my desires, from ego, from whatever kind of my own agenda might be that might blind me from what God actually has to say to me? It's complicated. It's not easy. It's not, you know, it's not a one track thing. But that's, to me, that is the religious life. That is the project that we're in, is distinguishing God's voice.
And that's, then we're back to, where is it written, right? And the whole setup of this interesting, kind of flawed but brilliant exploration of text and person and gender and love and how can you find freedom.
Catch it at a movie theater near you.
Barbra Streisand's Yentl.
The Gospel of Musical Theater is a production of Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland, Oregon. Join Peter and Nathan every other Friday right here in your podcast feed, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at Gospel of MT. Learn more and support us at trinity-episcopal.org/podcasts. See you next time.